Why are murder mysteries so satisfying?
I have this belief that murder mysteries satisfy us because all fiction is about a search for the truth. I think the satisfaction of a murder mystery is that in this quest for truth, it is the one form of writing where every I is dotted, every T is crossed. You know, the beauty of a whodunit is it has closure.
That's Anthony Horowitz. We talk with him about his latest novel, Magpie Murders, and about writing great mystery fiction. Then, the battle to save net neutrality is gearing up. We reach back into our archives for some very prescient conversations about the threats to the open internet and what to do about them. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Anthony Horowitz is a star of the murder mystery genre in books, film, and television. He's the writer of the BBC mystery series Foyle's War, Poirot, and the early episodes of Midsummer Murders. He wrote the Sherlock Holmes books The House of Silk and Moriarty, also adapted for TV, and the James Bond novel Trigger Mortis, among numerous other works. Horowitz is at the top of his game with his latest novel, Magpie Murders. It's a mystery within a mystery that spills the secrets of writing whodunits. It features a mystery writer who's murdered and a literary editor who turns sleuth. She finds the clues embedded in her client's last mystery novel. The plots are ingenious, but perhaps the most delicious aspect is the peek Horowitz gives the reader into the process of writing good mystery fiction. Magpie Murders is out from HarperCollins and was published in June of this year. Anthony Horowitz, welcome to Writer's Voice.
It's a great pleasure to be with you. Thank you very much.
So, Magpie Murders, this was hugely entertaining. It's two mystery novels wrapped up in one. One of them is about the death of a famous mystery writer, with the sleuth being his editor. And the other is the last novel that was written by that writer, sent to the publisher just before his death. Tell us a little bit more about kind of the framework, the structure of this book, what it's about, obviously without giving too much away.
Thank you. It is a difficult book to talk about because there are so many surprises in it, and of course I have to be careful about guarding the ending. But you're absolutely right in your description. The book starts with what reads like a sort of a golden age of detective fiction story set in about 1955 in an English village called Saxby-on-Avon, where there's the usual assortment of characters, including a vicar and a doctor and the squire in his manor house, and there's a murder, and then a detective called Atticus Punt arrives and investigates. But as the book goes on, we realize that this book has been written by a modern writer whose name is Alan Conway. And unfortunately, before he reaches the last crucial chapter of who actually committed the crime in his book, he himself dies. And his death is then investigated by his editor, who is a lady called Susan Ryland. And in investigating his death, she discovers that everybody in the book that he wrote exists in real life. That's her first discovery. And the second discovery is that one of those characters may have murdered him. So as you say, it's an intertwining double detective story with two quite distinct endings.
And it's not just two mystery novels, but really this structure allows you to take a fascinating look at the craft of writing mysteries itself. So what inspired you to spill the beans, as it were, to your readers?
Thank you again for those kind words. I mean, yes, I've always loved murder mysteries and writing crime and reading it and all these books. But the older I get, the more I feel that it's not enough just to write a murder mystery. But it's, you know, I love to beguile my readers and to give them the puzzles and the clues and the suspects and the surprise ending. But I also want to do a little bit more. And I have become very, very interested in the relationship between the detective and the reader and indeed the writer and the whole concern construction of whodunits and why we enjoy them so much. Why are there so many murders in literature, not just in sort of mystery novels, but every even great writers, Dickens, Shakespeare, have used murder as the mainspring of a story. So I have become interested in looking at the sort of my own life, really, as a writer, and how these things are constructed and how it's done. It's a little bit like Penn and Teller, who not only do magic tricks, but occasionally show you themselves doing those magic tricks with all the mechanics on display. That, I guess, is what I've tried to do in this book.
Well, let's start out with that question. Why do we seem to need murder mysteries? What attracts us to them?
Well, you know, I have this belief that murder mysteries satisfy us because all fiction is about a search for the truth. That, I think, is where we begin. It's why we read. A book has to have an element of truth in it to attract us in the first place. And I think that great literature tells us something about ourselves and society we haven't seen before. Now, I'm not calling Magpie Murders great literature, but I think the satisfaction of a murder mystery is that in this quest for truth, it is the one form of writing where every I is dotted, every T is crossed. You know, the beauty of a whodunit is it has closure. You know, the butler did it, the doctor did it, this is the reason why it happened, and this is the result of everything being investigated. It closes down, and I think that has a huge satisfaction for us as readers, particularly in a world where truth is often quite hard to find. 24-hour news, all the political events that keep happening, one on top of the other, make us, I think, more doubtful than we ever were about our world and our place in it. So I think there is something very, very comforting in detective fiction. And there's another side to it as well, which I like very much. I can't think of a type of fiction or book of any sort, really, where the reader and the central character, who is the detective, are so united because they have exactly the same objective, which is to find the truth. They travel through the book shoulder to shoulder. They meet the suspects. They look at the clues. They work out the latest developments. They do it together. So I think as a read, there is also something very enticing about the detective novel, and that is why I've always enjoyed it myself.
So the axis around which the plot spins is, in fact, the missing final chapter of Cranston's mystery novel. And I have to say that when I read it, you know, it goes through about halfway of the book is the novel within the novel. It lacks the last chapter. I was incredibly frustrated. I was tempted to jump ahead to see if I could find that missing chapter, but luckily I didn't but this just to tell you just exactly how frustrating it is. You're just left hanging in the most annoying way.
Well, I actually, you know, I do refer to this because the first part of the book, the first 200-odd pages, are being read by the editor, Susan Ryland, and she comes herself to this blank page, which is where the book ends, and I think her first words in the second part of the book are, annoying, isn't it? And she herself is absolutely livid. She's the editor of this book. She needs it. The publishing house is going to go under unless they can produce another successful book, and of course, the whodunit is the one book which you cannot publish with the last chapter missing. Other books you might be able to fill in a little bit, but every whodunit needs its solution. So the whole then second half of the book becomes this desperate search for this missing chapter. And I love the fact, incidentally, that the chapter, when it is finally discovered, is part of the reason why Alan Conway is killed. So, you know, the real world and the fictitious world, and I'm not giving too much away here, but they do sort of fight with each other and connect with each other in unexpected ways.
Yeah, and you know, in the beginning of the novel within the novel, the one about Atticus Punt, he's investigating two deaths that seem to be unrelated, but right as soon as almost as that he gets involved, he tells the reader that they are related. But we don't get to find out, of course, until the very end of the two books. How do you construct the balance between revealing clues and keeping them hidden?
Well, it's one of the things I love doing most, I must be honest. You're right, the first book, which is Magpie Murders, a sort of 1950s mystery, has a cleaner who has either fallen or been pushed down a flight of stairs, and then Sir Magnus Pye, the lord of the manor, as it were, who I won't say what happens to him, but it's not very pleasant. And it is trying to find a connection between these two deaths that is the mainspring of the first part of the book. And I am quite proud of the reason for the murder, which I think is very original, hasn't been done before to my knowledge, and surprising. When I write a book, you know, and I deliver it to my publisher, the first question I ask is not sort of did you enjoy it, or what did you think of the language or the characters, it's did you guess it? And I think for me the most fun in a whodunit is if a reader can get to the solution and be fooled, but allow for the fact that the solution was there in front of them. You know, when I read an Agatha Christie, that's what I love about it. Agatha always fools me, but she always plays fair with me too. So that was what I was trying to do. Now, much, much more complicated than that was to tie in the first two deaths in the first part of the book with the death of Alan Conway himself, which is sort of the second part of the book. And that was a piece of engineering. And why it was difficult was it has to be an easy read. You know, for your listeners who are listening to this, or for readers who want to read it, I don't think there's a lot of pleasure in reading a book if you get confused and you're back flicking through the pages to try and find out who somebody was or what's going on or who is connected to what, who in what way. So the most work that I had to do was to make sure that all these different clues interconnected in a way that was easy to sort of understand. And you ask how I did that. Well, on my desk in front of me is a notebook. That notebook has about 30 pages. It is covered in scribbles and notes and diagrams and arrows and characters linking to each other and crossings out and questions to myself. And I just wrote it and wrote it and wrote it until I finally got it right.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with mystery writer Anthony Horowitz about his latest whodunit, Magpie Murders.
And do you do that chart as you're writing the book, or is it all plotted out beforehand?
I have to start with a pretty good structure. You know, for a book like this, which is, as I say, quite complicated, I couldn't possibly do it unless I had most of the clues worked out, and definitely the sort of the main clues and obviously the identity of the killers and the methods of murder and all that stuff. And so, obviously, as I'm writing, I extrapolate a bit. I add things and I get new ideas. I go in different directions. But there has to be, I think, a strong structure at the beginning for the book to work.
So a couple more questions then about writing and structure. Susan Ryland says at one point that character names and mysteries are very important. The simpler, the better. I wasn't sure I really understood that. And, of course, Atticus Punt is a very strange name.
Well, Atticus Punt is half Greek, half German. He has got a history, which explains why he's got a name. And I'll be honest that, you know, Hercule Poirot was sort of knocking on the door of my imagination a little bit, and I was doing my best to try and avoid being too similar to him. And I think it is important, incidentally, that your central detective should be, you know, a slightly eccentric, slightly larger-than-life character. Certainly in a 1950s novel, in the modern novel, Susan Ryland is just a hard-working woman, a career woman, working in publishing, and, you know, is less of an eccentric. But that's because the book is more modern. So I forget now quite what the question was you asked me.
Why are character names so important?
Yeah, character names. I think the thing for me that matters is that the names should be memorable in a way that allows you to know exactly who you're talking about. So that it's I think that a book as you know, this is a 400 or 500 page novel, and it's got a lot of different twists and turns and things happening in it. So it's very important that when you meet a character, you know very quickly who they are. So Clarissa Pye, for example, who is the sister of Sir Magnus Pye, that's not a name you're going to forget very easily, and it sort of sits with her, and I think that in some ways it suits her character. This is something I learned from Charles Dickens, whose characters often have names that somehow tell you a little bit or even quite a lot about them. Wackford Squeers, the unpleasant headmaster, Nicholas Nickleby is a good example. It's just a device, I think, to make it an easier and more immediate read.
Now, you are the author of many bestsellers, most recently Trigger Mortis, also the Sherlock Holmes mysteries Moriarty and House of Silk, as well as the creator of the TV series Midsummer Murders and Foyle's War. And I have to just say, Foyle's War is one of my favorite all-time series.
You're very kind. Thank you.
Yes. I was very sad to see that come to an end.
Not as sad as me.
Oh, really?
Oh, well, I love doing Foyle's War. I mean, Foyle's War was a labor of love. I worked on it for 16 years. I wrote 23 two-hour films for it. I did hundreds and hundreds of hours of research and writing. I worked with Michael Kitchen from the very start, and, of course, Honeysuckle Weeks as well. And my wife was the producer on it, so it was very much a family affair. Both my sons have appeared in it in different times. And so it was a wonderful journey to make. But, unfortunately, I just felt that I had done enough, and I'd run out of stories, and I wanted to quit while I was ahead. You know, I had to stop sometime, so I did.
Yeah. So then I started watching Midsummer Murders after reading Magpie Murders, because I knew that you had been the creator of that. And I found a lot of tropes in common. I mean, for example, Punt's hapless assistant James is like Troy in Midsummer Murders. And I got the feeling that it wasn't so much recycling tropes as commentary on them. Am I right?
Yes, that's true. I should just correct you on one thing, which is although I did actually help to create the television series of Midsummer Murders, they were based on the novels of Caroline Graham, who had written about Inspector Barnaby and his assistant Troy long before I ever heard of it. If there's one gift I've given to the English language, it's a title, because I was the one who called it Midsummer Murders, and that's sort of where that has come from. And I wrote the first 7 episodes of it, so quite a lot of skullduggery going on there. And wrote and then went from that to do Foyle's War afterwards. So that's the only thing I would correct you on that.
Yeah, so I wonder if you could talk about kind of the tropes, because that's also, you know, as you pointed out at the start of this interview, you know, there you took a lot of tropes from Agatha Christie.
I don't think I took anything particularly from Midsummer Murders, because Caroline Graham was inspired by Agatha Christie. She memorably referred to her creation as Agatha Christie on acid. And I think what was brilliant about that original show was that she went for those sort of English villages, the thatched roofs, the village ponds, old ladies on tricycles. And when she added to that mixture something very dark and devious at its heart, so behind the net curtains, people were getting up to all sorts of unpleasant things, and it was really quite black. As the show has progressed, incidentally, it has, I think, become a little more parodic. I still love it. I think it's still a hugely enjoyable show, but I think it is less now credible than it was. The murders have become very, very extreme. So I wouldn't say that I was particularly inspired by Midsummer Murders when I wrote Magpie Murders, despite, incidentally, those similar alliterating titles. But I would admit that my inspiration was the same as Caroline's, but I think I was much, much more driven by St. Mary's Mead, which is the village where Miss Marple lives. Of course, all these MMs in this conversation, in Agatha Christie.
Okay, so, but there again, you know, in other kinds of fiction, if you adopted the tropes of other writers, you would be accused of being derivative or even, you know, plagiaristic. But this is totally not true in murder mysteries. It's almost as if it's part of the ritual.
Well, again, I'm very grateful to you for not using, you know, for not accusing me of plagiarizing or stealing my ideas, because I try very, very hard to write books that have never been done really before. Even Moriarty, which is, again, very much inspired by a particular Agatha Christie novel, I hope is a book that will surprise, because it's, you know, it's original, it's different, and I don't want to be a slavish imitator. But the fact of the matter is that in murder mystery writing, pretty much every modern criminal writer is at least to an extent indebted to the great grandfather of all these books, Arthur Conan Doyle, who more or less invented what we now consider to be the modern detective story, which has a first act, which is a crime, a second act, which is an investigation, a third act, which is a solution, and then a detective who is solving the crime, and a sidekick, obviously Holmes, and in this case Watson, who describes what is happening. And so that template has been used and used again, whether it's Peter Wimsey, or whether it's Hercule Poirot, or whether it's Barnaby, or whether it's my own books. So I don't think it is plagiarism, but it is a sort of a tradition. And again, one of the, I think one of the pleasant aspects of writing whodunits and of reading them is that it's a world that is very familiar. It's a world in which you sort of know where you are. And that part of the reason for that is that it is a very traditional world and a very well-trodden path.
Hmm. Yeah, and so all the invention really comes in the plot, the clues, the kind of all that other stuff, all that structure allows for one to go through some well-trod paths to very surprising conclusions, especially ones that are really driven by character. I wonder if you could talk about character in mystery novels.
Well, yes, again, this is it's interesting to talk about that because, of course, character is vital to writing generally, but not always necessarily to whodunits. I mean, there are those who would argue, I don't personally agree, but there are some who say that Agatha Christie's characters are skin deep, but they are almost sort of ciphers and simply carrying the web of the plot. Now, I think Agatha Christie does actually draw quite good characters, though, from a fairly limited pool. I mean, of villages, the aristocracy, white-collar workers, that seems to be the world she inhabits. One could argue pretty much the same thing about Doyle, that his characters, brilliantly drawn though they are also from a fairly narrow band of people. Now, in Magpie Murders, I think in the two halves of the book, in the first half, the characters are, how can I put this? They are more obviously drawn. I mean, you know, the doctor is the doctor, and the vicar is very much the vicar, and the man who owns the antique shop is a bit of a scallywag. So they are sort of types that you will recognize from murder mystery tropes, from whether it be, you know, Murder, She Wrote, for example, had very similar characters, the Angela Lansbury show. And so they are very recognizable. I think they are less so in the second half, where you begin to look at people in a much more modern and a more subtle way. So, for example, Alan Conway himself is found to have had a very unfortunate relationship in his marriage, and as a result of that, his sexuality has been discussed in public. I'm speaking carefully so as not to give too much away. And the characters are slightly more shades of grey. And I think that's one of the interesting aspects, certainly for me when I wrote it, that the different types of writing in the book, from the sort of the golden age of crime fiction where characters are very recognizable to a more modern style of murder mystery where they're not, was part for me of the fun of writing it.
And so, Anthony Horowitz, your character, Alan Cranston, I mean, one aspect of his character in Magpie Murders is that he has a love-hate relationship to mystery writing, and that may be being generous. In fact, he would prefer to be a serious writer, but he's not any good at it. What drove that aspect of his character in that book?
Well, the inspiration for that was actually Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who created the greatest detective in all modern fiction, Sherlock Holmes, but had a disdain for him and thought that somehow Sherlock Holmes was beneath him, that this was just populist nonsense. And so what did he do? He threw Sherlock Holmes off the Reichenbach Falls so that he could get on with writing what he thought was his serious work, books which I'm sure many of your listeners will have no acquaintance with whatsoever. Micah Clarke, The White Circle, historical romances, even the Brigadier Gerard books, which I'm very fond of, haven't quite stood the test of time. And Holmes, Doyle himself realized that he had no choice but to bring Holmes back because in the later part of his life he needed the money for a house he'd bought. He had to pay off a mortgage and it was a huge house, Undershore it was called. And so he was persuaded for sums of money that would have turned him into the J.K. Rowling of his time to resuscitate Sherlock Holmes, and that's what he did in The Empty House, which is, of course, the sequel to, as it were, The Final Problem. So that was the inspiration for my book, the idea of a writer who has a disdain for his main character. I should say that Ian Fleming, another hero of mine, obviously, also had some misgivings about James Bond as not really being anything more than a sort of a boy's own yard. You know, I think he called him a fairy story for kids or words to that effect. And I think that a lot of, you know, very successful major writers have fallen out of love with their main characters, and I think that's something that's really fun to explore.
Is that something you're afraid will happen to you?
No. I mean, I've written Alex Rider, of course, for 11 books. There's a new one coming out in the fall. And this is a 14-year-old reluctant spy. And there are times when I look at him and think to myself, you know, I've been writing him now for, what, 17, 18 years. He's still 14, and I'm now into my 60s, which hardly seems particularly fair. He's saved the world countless times. He's popular, he's young, he's fun. And there is an element to me that feels slightly jealous of him until I remember, of course, that he is my own creation. So I sort of get it, but I've never fallen out of love with Alex. I just still, you know, he's a character I'm very proud to have created and one that has, you know, got lots of kids reading. So, and as I say, he's coming back, and I couldn't have been happier writing a new book about him.
Oh, that's great. Now, just a final question. You have written screenplays for TV series, and you've written these novels. What are some of the main differences, I'd say, between writing screenplays and writing the novels, as you do in the mystery field?
Wow, that's a very big question to end on. I'm going to duck it a little bit by saying I've always thought, actually, it's the similarities that are more interesting. You know, that for me, total immersion in a story, getting to know the character, not wanting to stop watching or to stop reading, pace, adventure, suspense, excitement, the fact that you never let your reader or your viewer go. These are, to me, what unite these different types of writing, whether it is a television play, a film, a screenplay, or a book. The difference is they're more technical. They're more to do with the fact that a screenplay written by me is a blueprint. It's not the finished job. It's going to have 60, 70 different people working on it. And I don't need to tell the actor how to act. I don't need to describe the set for the set designer and decorator. I don't need to talk about the lighting because the cinematographer will do that. I don't even really need to describe the props because there'll be a prop master, ditto the costume. Somebody else will come in and do all that for me. So all I'm really writing is a sort of a blueprint. I'm writing with sort of the scaffolding rather than the building, if you like. I don't have to lay every single brick. I don't have to use hundreds and hundreds of words to describe, you know, what is there. In a book, everything exists because of me. In film and television, that's also true, but I've only had to do the scaffolding to get it there. So I suppose that's the sort of the main similarities and the main differences. I would say one other thing, which is that I love writing. I'm very, very passionate about what I do. I've been writing for a very long time now. I still get the same pleasure and excitement out of writing, and that's something else that unites my television, film, and my book work, which is that I love doing it.
Mm. Well, it's all really terrific, and so is Magpie Murders. Anthony Horowitz, this has been such an interesting conversation. Thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a complete pleasure. Thank you.
In addition to Magpie Murders, Anthony Horowitz is the author of numerous books and screenplays, including the Alex Rider Mysteries, Foyle's War, Poirot, and Trigger Mortis. Magpie Murders is out from HarperCollins. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from the novel. Next up, The Battle to Save the Internet. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. There are two existential threats to Internet freedom. One is collusion between Internet service providers and government in invading users' privacy for the purposes of surveillance. The other is the stripping away of net neutrality. Later, we'll talk about the current battle for net neutrality in the light of the recent decision by the FCC to end its protections. But first, the fight to protect privacy on the Internet erupted over the roller coaster saga of the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act, or CISPA. It was first passed by the U.S. House of Representatives in 2012, but killed in the Senate after a storm of protests from outraged millions. CISPA was revived again in 2013, again passed the House, and stalled in the Senate. After more iterations of the same story and a tweak to its name, a version was tucked into the federal budget at the end of 2015. That gives you an idea of just how tenacious a bill can be that's wildly unpopular with the American people, but supported by big corporations. Let's hear a clip from my 2012 interview with Rebecca MacKinnon, not long after the U.S. House of Representatives passed CISPA. MacKinnon is the author of Consent of the Networked, The Worldwide Struggle for Internet Freedom.
She's now director of the Ranking Digital Rights Project. In this clip, I've just told Rebecca McKinnon about my first experience with the Internet in the late 1980s. At the time, I remember thinking, this is incredible that here is a kind of network that has been given to the world for free by not only the government, but by the defense part of the government, by ARPA, and yet this is the greatest democratic access to media that has ever happened. And the thought occurred to me then, how long is this going to last?
Yeah, well, I mean, it is an amazing thing. And one reason why it's so amazing is that the engineers who originally invented the Internet, while they may have been getting some defense money, were also kind of, you know, 60s hippies in a lot of ways, and believed in, you know, free expression. They designed the network in a very decentralized way. They made protocols that they offered up to the world for free. They didn't try and patent and trademark the basic technical standards that the whole thing ran on, so that people could then innovate and add things to it and use it without having to get permission or having to pay somebody. And, you know, one of the central points of the book is that, you know, the Internet, what it is today, what you can and cannot do on it today, the fact that it's globally interconnected, the extent to which you're able to be anonymous, the extent to which you can do things on it, add websites and add applications, innovate on it without central permission, this is all not due to some, you know, natural force. This is because a lot of human beings made specific decisions about the software, about the engineering protocols. Regulators made specific decisions. Lawyers and businesses made specific decisions about how their businesses were going to work. And all of this has added up to the kind of Internet we have today. But that can change. And so my argument is that whether or not the Internet evolves in the future in a way that remains compatible with democracy, with dissent, with unpopular speech, with whistleblowing, or whether it evolves in a way that makes such things increasingly difficult, really depends on everybody who's shaping the network, including government regulators, including companies, and including the people who use it. And my point is, we need to stop thinking of ourselves as passive users of this technology, and we need to start thinking of ourselves as citizens of the Internet. And if we want the Internet to continue to be a place that we can use to speak truth to power, to advocate for our own rights, we need to fight to make sure that we have sufficient privacy on these networks, that censorship is constrained because it's really spreading around the world. And you can't assume that it's just naturally going to work out okay just because it's the Internet. I mean, it's just kind of like, you know, in your community, whatever city you might live in, if you want your rights to be protected and respected, you want your interests to be protected and respected in your city, if you make no effort to pay any attention to the politics of the city or to what companies and the government are doing, and if you don't push back when you see things happening you don't like, don't be surprised when things don't turn out in a way that is respectful of your rights. You know, that you have to engage if you want your rights to be protected in your physical life, and similarly in our digital lives, if we want our rights and interests to be protected and respected, we're going to have to work for that. We're going to have to push companies to enact policies and practices that are respectful of the kind of digital world we want to live in. We need to push government. We need to pay attention to what kinds of law enforcement and cybersecurity policies and laws are being passed, and are they sufficiently respectful of our privacy and our civil liberties? And I think we saw earlier this year, you know, there was this bill that Congress nearly passed called the Stop Online Piracy Act, and the intent of that bill was narrow. It was meant to just deal with, you know, online copyright violation, but the solutions that were being advocated involved censorship and also involved requiring internet companies and anybody running websites to really monitor what their users were uploading or transmitting to make sure that they don't transmit any copyright infringing content. But that also, that basically results in people having to set up greater surveillance mechanisms, you know, as in the fabric of their businesses. And a lot of civil liberties groups were very concerned about that. And American voters called their congresspeople in very large numbers to say, you know, we may be concerned about intellectual property, but this is not the right way to fight it. I'm concerned about my ability to use the internet in a free manner, and that bill was stopped. And I think that was an example of how people are starting to recognize that we do need to pay attention to these types of issues.
We're talking with Rebecca MacKinnon about her book, Consent of the Networked: The Worldwide Struggle for Internet Freedom. You mentioned the word citizens, and in your book, Consent of the Networked, you talk in the book about the digital commons. Here, what you've just talked about is being a net citizen, a citizen of the digital commons, and also copyright, which is all about, in some way, the corporate enclosure of that digital commons. What is the domain that is open to citizenship, and what is the domain that is rendered under the corporate Caesar?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is a problem. It's becoming more and more murky. You know, increasingly we are dependent on digital devices, services, and platforms that are owned and operated by the private sector, not only, you know, for our social lives and our businesses and our jobs and our schooling and so on, but also for our political activity. The public square has moved into these privately run spaces. And so there's one question of, you know, to what extent should we try and take the, you know, create more spaces online that are not run by companies, that are more non-commercial, and create a larger commons so that there's more room for the political discourse to happen without having to be concerned about your data being excessively collected for commercial purposes and other issues like that. But at the same time, you're seeing, you know, let's take Facebook, for example. You know, you look at, say, for instance, political campaigns. The Obama campaign reelection strategy is heavily dependent on Facebook. You know, a lot of organizations, activist organizations, trying to reach broad swaths of the public are all using Facebook because that's where everybody is. You know, that's where everybody has gone. And so one really important question is, given that the public square and given that our politics have moved into these private domains, if we want democracy to survive in a form that's recognizable as democracy and in a form where controversial speech, unpopular people have the ability to speak out without feeling excessively endangered, do these private companies actually have an obligation to serve the public interest to, you know, some degree? I'm not saying that we should nationalize these companies or, you know, require that every feature on Facebook be put to a vote of all the users, but do we need to have some mechanisms by which we get these companies to commit to core principles on free expression, on privacy, on civil liberties, and that their platforms and services need to be run in a way that is compatible with essentially human rights and compatible with a free public discourse, because otherwise they're going to render, you know, the entire sort of political environment unsustainable, or they're going to take it in a direction we don't want it to go. And so just as we expect companies, you know, yes, okay, their primary, you know, the primary business is to turn profits and so on, but we also expect that companies have an obligation not to render our air unbreathable or our water undrinkable We expect companies not to hire 12-year-olds, even though that might make them more profitable, and to respect the rights of their workers, and to not destroy both the environment and the general living conditions of the communities that they operate in. The idea that they need to behave in a sustainable manner is something we expect of companies. And while companies are far from perfect, I think for the most part, certainly American industry does not deny that they have these responsibilities. And I think similarly, we really need to push for companies to recognize that with their power comes responsibility, that they are having an impact ultimately on our political environment, and they need to behave in a way that's sustainable.
Rebecca McKinnon. That was a clip from my 2012 interview with her about her book, Consent of the Networked. McKinnon pointed to the responsibility internet companies have to protect the interests of their customers. Net neutrality is also crucially important to the interests of internet users. But ISPs like Comcast and Verizon have long pushed to end net neutrality, and now, with new Trump appointees to the FCC, they've succeeded. In May, the FCC began undoing Obama-era net neutrality rules. In a 2-to-1 vote along party lines, the Republicans on the commission voted to begin loosening the regulations on the ISPs. But the fight back is ramping up. On July 12th, nearly 70,000 websites and organizations are taking part in massive online protests to save net neutrality. In 2008, I interviewed Josh Silver, who then directed the organization Free Press, a leading advocate for net neutrality. And while the events referenced in the interview happened almost a decade ago, it's uncanny how 2017 seems like 2008 all over again. So I thought it'd be good to air this slice of what is now history to illuminate the renewed fight over net neutrality. We turn now to an issue that's been on simmer for a while, but just in the past week has come again to a boil. On Monday in Boston, the FCC held a hearing about network neutrality. That's the idea that users should be able to access all internet content equally easily, without internet providers being able to slow or block access to sites they prefer to steer customers away from. For example, rival sites providing movie content, or sites disagreeing with the company's political views. Monday's FCC hearing was held to look into allegations that one of the big players in the debate over network neutrality, service provider Comcast, was blocking internet traffic. But Comcast also was doing some physical jamming of rival viewpoints at the hearing. They hired people off the street to pack seats at the meeting and effectively kept many opponents out of the room. To help us make sense of the issue, we turn to my next guest, Josh Silver. He's head of the national advocacy organization Free Press, which has offices in Washington, D.C. and Northampton, Massachusetts. Josh Silver, welcome to Writer's Voice again.
Thank you.
We've had you on before talking about the all-important issue of net neutrality, network neutrality, and of preserving our free speech. It's been much in the news this week because there was a big to-do over in Boston at an FCC hearing. I've already told our listeners a little bit about that, and also about the Comcast seat warmers that were paid to fill the room. But tell us what exactly was going on in Boston, and what did Comcast do?
Francesca, there is a huge debate that's happening, it's underway, over the future of the Internet. And it is, as you say, it is all important because, you know, this really is a fight not just about sort of gigabytes and terabytes. This is about the future of virtually all communications in this country. Television, radio, phone service, it's all moving to the Internet. So what happens here in the world of policymaking over the next couple of years will really determine whether or not every website could be like a TV network or a radio network. It's a profound importance. What happened on Monday at Harvard University in Cambridge in Massachusetts was that there was a hearing held by the Federal Communications Commission chairman with all five FCC commissioners present to haul Comcast Corporation up in front of them under proven allegations that Comcast had indeed been blocking content going over their pipes, content that went to Comcast subscribers that they slowed down or even blocked, an application called BitTorrent. The reason this is of particular concern, BitTorrent is a program that allows users to send large files over the internet, like video, radio programs, large files that are in direct competition with Comcast's video service that they are increasingly moving to a digital platform as well. So what's interesting is Comcast knew things were going to get ugly, and they ended up, to our amazement, hiring dozens of people off the street, giving them what we've heard to be $100 each, to actually go into the hearing and sit there and take up the chairs that would have otherwise been held by genuinely concerned citizens who wanted to know more about this issue and who are not happy about what Comcast has done.
And they showed up an hour and a half early, right?
They showed up at 7:30 in the morning, and a quote from the Harvard staffer said, "I think it's disingenuous to say that they were holding spots for Comcast employees," because the Comcast VIPs were saying, "Oh no, these people were only there to hold their spot in our spot in line. They didn't stay through this hearing." When in fact it was proven that that none of these so-called Comcast employees ever came, and these hired guns just sat there and blocked what ended up being over 100 people who were genuinely there to take part, blocked them from getting into the hearing.
Now, this hearing was about BitTorrent. This is something that a whole lot of people use. But it's not just Comcast that's doing things like this. This is bigger than just this one issue.
Well, it's bigger than this one issue on several levels. I mean, Comcast is the one who's been most brazen about it, but there is really just a much larger issue at stake here. The whole issue of net neutrality is really, again, it's about whether or not companies like Comcast or Verizon, which control 96% of broadband high-speed connections in the Bay State, whether or not they are allowed to slow down or block content over the internet based on who's sending it. So what they're saying is, trust us. We don't need laws that prevent us from blocking content because we're good players. We're not going to do anything bad. Then they were found out. They were discovered by investigative reporters and some techno geeks to be blocking this BitTorrent service. So the irony here is they're not only blocking content on the web, they're blocking ordinary citizens from coming to a hearing like the federal communications hearing on Monday to really get involved in the issue. We can't trust these folks. There can't be this kind of gatekeeping on the internet, and people should be outraged.
I think a lot of people don't, they don't think about maybe the issue of net neutrality as being a democracy issue, but when they see Comcast coming in, and they've admitted to this as well, is that right? Then it becomes a much clearer, the whole issue of democracy and access to expression.
Sure, and even more important, sometimes we forget, we are in a participatory democracy, and democracy requires an informed citizenry, and people increasingly realize, as we sort of come out of the fog of the past 7 years particularly, that the real greatest problem in this country is the fact that well over 70% of the American population get their news from commercial television news, not from public radio, not from Pacifica or NPR. And they're not getting hard-hitting critical journalism. And so when we look at the issue of creating diversity of media content, of creating and cultivating investigative journalism by opening up access and distribution to crucial information like these issues are about, we're seeing that this is really about whether or not the lifeblood of democracy will course through the veins of the United States or whether it will be stopped by companies like Comcast and Verizon.
You talk about, or Free Press, actually, which, by the way, our listeners can go to freepress.net, where all of this is talked about, as well as savetheinternet.net. And we will link to those websites from our website at writersvoice.net. On that website, it's talked about an issue as between a closed and open internet. say something about that. What do you mean by closed? This issue of power, you've already said something about control over BitTorrent trying to stop that, but what are some of the other ways in which internet access is being controlled or tamped down by these companies, or could be?
Well, it's actually quite simple, and what it means is, if you think back 10 years ago, many people were just starting to get dial-up internet connections, and if you recall, you had choices. There was Earthlink, there was Net Zero, there was in Massachusetts here, there was something called JavaNet. There were many different providers. It pushed the cost of monthly access to dial-up internet, which is painfully slow, to sometimes as low as $5 or $10 a month. There was competition that was created by a federal law that told companies like Verizon or AT&T that they had to share the lines going into people's homes with these internet competitors. What's happened since then is that federal government policies have closed the internet so that there's no longer laws that tell Verizon or AT&T or Comcast that they have to share the wires going into homes to other competitors. That's why 96% of Americans have one or two choices, DSL or cable, and no others, and that's why we have a closed system that cuts off any real competition. If we had open access laws that forced competition and allowed other entrepreneurs and internet service providers to compete, we wouldn't have most of these problems.
You know, I just went through this very issue myself because I got tired of Verizon's high phone fees and decided to go to voice over internet service. I went with Vonage, and I think at some point I'm going to migrate to the even cheaper Skype. But as a result, I get DSL service from Verizon. They gave me what is called a dry line, which means that they basically are giving me less service, but they're charging me $10 more a month for this. And when I went looking around for maybe some other way of getting DSL or internet access, the only other option is Comcast, and that's just as expensive, if not more so, right there. So I'm stuck.
You're stuck, and there's not going to be any improvement unless the government steps in and does what they've done since 1934, when policies started regulating things like that, like radio and television, that really mandate competition. You have to realize, in the last 5 years, the United States has slipped from number 5 to number 16 globally in broadband penetration. You can go to a place like Japan or France or South Korea, and you can get internet speeds that are 10, 20, 30 times faster than here and for a third of the price. And that's because there is competition, and when things don't work well with Verizon, you've got 10 other service providers you can choose from. And the only reason that this has continued to go this way is because of the immense power that these companies have in Washington, with millions of dollars in campaign contributions, armies of lobbyists, and really one of the most corrupt policymaking systems in the developed world. And that's our job. Our job is to go to sites like freepress.net, savetheinternet.com, sign petitions to support legislation. Right now, there's legislation in the U.S. House of Representatives called the Internet Freedom Preservation Act that would fix this problem. And it really is time for people across the country to get involved with media issues and understand that they are critical to every issue that everyone cares about.
Now, say that again. What is that legislation that's up? And tell us just very briefly in the less than a minute that we have left what it is, and then give those websites again, because I think I gave the wrong website before.
It's called the Internet Freedom Preservation Act. It was introduced by Representatives Markey and Pickering in the U.S. House of Representatives recently. It would reinforce network neutrality laws and promote open access. It would force the FCC to ensure competition, and it would really go a long way towards fixing this problem. I think one thing that is encouraging, there are several candidates, the major Democratic candidates have come out in support of net neutrality and against media concentration. I think there is a growing movement that's coming together at savetheinternet.com and freepress.net, and it's important that people go there and learn more.
Josh Silver,
formerly of Free Press, who I interviewed in 2008. Free Press is still fighting for net neutrality and participating in the current campaign. Go to writersvoice.net for links to that and other sites where you can find out more. And now for some summer reading picks. As listeners may know, climate change is a preoccupation of mine. But you don't have to be a climate hawk to love sci-fi master Kim Stanley Robinson's new book, New York 2140. It's set in a time when Lower Manhattan has become a kind of super Venice, sitting in the drink of the East and Hudson Rivers, while the billionaires build their new 300-story skyscrapers on the northern cliffs of the island. Unlike much climate sci-fi, New York 2140 isn't really dystopian fiction. Rather, it's a realistic but ultimately hopeful look at the resilience of New Yorkers to meet the challenges of their time and our future. For anybody who cares about their health, Andrew Weil's new book, Mind Over Meds, is an engaging and balanced look at the American tendency to take too many medications. He acknowledges the important role pharmaceuticals play when appropriately prescribed, but he says we take too many too much. Mind Over Meds suggests some alternatives to medications and also tells the reader when it's better to let the body heal on its own. It's a great read, even for the beach. You don't have to go to the beach to relish reading my next pick. In fact, you might even enjoy it more if you go to the Catskill Mountains of upstate New York. The book is The Quarry Fox by naturalist Leslie Sharp. In stunning prose, Sharp illumines the lives of the creatures who inhabit the Catskills, spinning a tale of the web of life and our relationship to it. It's a treat not to be missed. And finally, we have a pick for the little ones. Leslie Newman attained fame with her 1989 children's book, Heather Has Two Mommies, about a young girl with lesbian parents. She's gone on to write some 70 books, the latest of which also tackles gender issues. Sparkle Boy is about a little boy who loves to dress up in pretty girly clothes. He likes to paint his nails like his big sister. He likes sparkly things. And why not? That's the attitude his mother takes, although his sister needs a bit of convincing. The book is for the 4-7 set, but it's a lovely read at any age. Happy summer reading! That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.